The content is the protected copyrighted property of the Murthy Law Firm. Please listen to copyright information and restrictions at the end of this recording.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us for our discussion today on non-immigrant visa waivers, also referred to as the 212 D3 NIV waivers. Joining me for today's discussion are two of my esteemed colleagues at the Murthy Law Firm, Maggie Wagner and Lori Haas, who practice in this area and handle these kinds of cases on a regular basis. And before we get into a whole bunch of details, we just want to focus on the crux of what is the reason why a person is even required to file a 212 D3 non-immigrant visa waiver. What does it mean? We're going to go over all of that with you, but the big three questions that need to be addressed upfront are, first, what is the exact reason or ground that of this inadmissibility or refusal? The second is waivable in the non-immigrant context. And third, could we, as your lawyers, persuade the consular officer and CBP's ARO, which is the Administrative Admissibility Review Office, that temporary entry should be granted and justified as a matter of discretion? So with that, let's get to the basics. Maggie, if I can have you jump in to describe and explain what is a 212 D3 NIV waiver and why would we need one?
Yeah, of course. Thank you, Sheila. So basically a 212 D3 waiver is a discretionary waiver that's available under the INA. And it allows someone who's been found inadmissible in the United States to be admitted temporarily as a non-immigrant. And the key word there is temporarily, because this is not a pathway to a green card. This is not a pathway to permanent residence. It really applies to people who are just seeking visitor visas, student visas, work visas, and other similar non-immigrant classifications. So in practical terms, it's for someone who has a prior issue that makes them legally inadmissible, but who wants to enter the United States for a specific temporary purpose.
Thanks, Maggie. Okay, so the next question, I guess, which is somewhat logical, but again, as many of you figured out, this does not apply to thousands and thousands of people, but percentage-wise, not an overwhelming. But what are the things that this NIV waiver cannot remedy or fix? Lori?
Sure. Thanks, Sheila. So, you know, while the 212 D3 waiver, which is the section of the INA that we're talking about, is a very broad waiver, it does not make someone eligible for a visa if they cannot independently qualify for that visa. For example, if the consular officer refuses the application under 214B, because the applicant has not shown eligibility for the non-immigrant classification or has not overcome immigrant intent, then there is no 212 D3 waiver, the NIV waiver that we're talking about. It also does not waive ordinary passport or visa documentation requirements, and it's not available for certain serious security, foreign policy, genocide, torture, or you know many other related grounds. So the first step is always to identify the exact ground of admissibility or refusal.
So that dives in very nicely to the next issue, which is what do we see as the most common grounds of inadmissibility that triggers the need for this 212 D3 NIV waiver? So as you can imagine, the most common prior immigration violations like overstaying your status. Sometimes health-related grounds can also come up, including certain medical or substance abuse related issues. So it's extremely broad, right? So in terms of actually the application and the process, how does it actually work? Maggie, I know you do these all the time.
Sure, so for most visa applicants, it just starts at the U.S. consulate the normal way. You know, the applicant applies for the non-immigrant visa, in the normal way. The consular officer is then going to make the determination whether the applicant is otherwise qualified for that visa, that specific visa that they are applying for, and whether any grounds of inadmissibility apply. And if the officer does find that the applicant is inadmissible, but they believe that a waiver should be recommended, the waiver request is going to be submitted through the consular process to the CBP Admissibility Review Office. Sometimes that's called the ARO, if you're familiar with that acronym as well. At the consular level, there is no separate USCIS form and no separate filing fee that the applicant has to request or fill out. It's just a submission that's usually a package, you know, comprised of a legal argument, a personal statement, and supporting documents. And so that's what's going to really convince the ARO whether or not the waiver should be issued. And there's also an important distinction between visa exempt travelers and visa waiver program travelers. So a Canadian who, for example, does not need a visa may use the CBP form I-192 process. So there is an actual process for that person. But a visa waiver program traveler who is inadmissible generally can't solve the problem by using the ESTA filing or by filing an I-192. That person usually has to apply for a visa through the U.S. consulate.
That's interesting, right, to understand that distinction between the two and how the process works. So working with your lawyer or with Murthy Law Firm, who may be familiar with how the process works and the nuances and the complexities involved, can make a world of difference. So, Lori, what role does the consular officer play in this? You know, are they the ones that kind of, I know we kind of touched a little bit upon this, but are they the ones who actually decide whether the waiver is approved or where does it go and how does it work? I know, Maggie, you do a bunch of these cases.
Yeah, so this is actually one of the most commonly misunderstood points in the process. The consular officer does not make the final waiver decision, but we think of them as like a gatekeeper. It's really a two-step process. Their role is to recommend, you know, they're the first line of defense, so to speak. They need to accept the waiver recommendation from the applicant, the visa applicant, and then their role is to recommend or decline to recommend that the waiver be granted. The law gives consular officers a very kind of important, strong discretionary function of recommending waivers to the Department of Homeland Security or DHS. In making that recommendation, the officer weighs whether the applicant is eligible to seek the waiver relief, whether the applicant is otherwise qualified for the visa, and whether the travel serves a legitimate purpose, and whether granting the waiver would be contrary to U.S. interests. So if they do recommend the waiver, the case then goes forward to the ARO. If they don't recommend the waiver, then there's generally no appeal rights to that decision. That's why we think of them as the gatekeeper. They, you need to kind of get through them to get to the ARO.
So, Lori, is it possible, for example, that if the officer says, sorry, I'm not going to recommend the waiver, that then obviously they're not going to recommend it, but could they still transmit it to the ARO?
No, they need to forward it with a recommendation. If they don't recommend it, then it stops there. There are some exceptions, which I think we'll get to, but for general purposes and for most people, there is no basis for appeal, and the only way to get to the ARO is through the consular recommendation.
Interesting. And, you know, I know enough cases, especially in the last year and a half, where even when and after the consular officer recommends the waiver, the ARO is, after 6 months or a year or a year and a half or 2 years, choosing to ignore it, and we've seen that, right? So I guess the next question is, once the consular officer recommends the waiver, where does it go? It goes to the CBPA Admissibility Review Office, or ARO, that we talked about. They're located in Herndon, Virginia. The ARO makes the final determination on whether the waiver is granted or not. And this is a separate DHS adjudication, not just a rubber stamp of the consular recommendation. So applicants need to be prepared for a significant wait time. current Department of State guidance indicates that these waivers could take about a year, 365 days, could be longer depending on the ARO workload. And there is no, you know, mandatory time frame or deadline. So obviously the earlier you apply, the better you are. So the next question then, if I can jump to you, Maggie, is what legal standard does the ARO apply when determining whether or not to grant this non-immigrant visa waiver?
Of course. So there's kind of two things that they consider. The first thing is the classic standard, and that's going to come from the 1978 Board of Immigration Appeals case called Matter of Haranka. And Haranka identifies three factors. The first one being, you know, the risk of harm to society if the applicant is admitted. The second one is the seriousness of the applicant's prior immigration or criminal violations. And the third is the applicant's reasons for wanting to enter the United States. So they'll consider all three of those. None of these are factors that are defined by a bright line rule, which is why it's so tricky and why discretion does play such a large role in whether or not the waiver is issued. The next standard is current State Department guidance also gives consular officers a practical framework for deciding whether or not to recommend a waiver. And the officers consider a couple things. They consider the recency and the seriousness of the conduct or condition causing the ineligibility, the reason for the proposed travel, the positive or negative effect of the travel on U.S. public interest, whether the case involves one isolated incident or if it's a pattern of misconduct, and evidence of reformation or rehabilitation. And the guidance also recognizes that there can be a positive U.S. public interest factor where an applicant has graduated from a U.S. institution of higher education or has earned credentials to engage in skilled labor in the United States and seek to travel to commence or continue employment with a U.S. employer in a field that's related to that education or credential. So a strong case doesn't just say, you know, please forgive what happened. It connects the facts to each of these discretionary factors.
Got it. Okay. So I know the question most commonly asked by all of our clients who have, of course, been waiting for weeks or months before they even sometimes come to us when they realize that there's an option to file the NIV waiver is, can these cases be expedited?
Yeah, Sheila, I wish I had the magic touch. These cases do take a very long time and even longer as of late. And whether or not they can be expedited is, I would say, generally sometimes, but not usually. And not just because the applicant bought a plane ticket or has an upcoming meeting or has a family member in need. Expedite requests are generally reserved for very urgent humanitarian situations such as medical treatment or a death in the family or cases involving clear and significant U.S. government public interest or public interest, I should say. You know, a strong expedite request needs to be very specific and supported by evidence. And I hate to say it, but the most practical approach is to start as early as possible because these waiver applications predictably take a very long time.
Okay. So I guess then the next question is, if the consular officer did not recommend that waiver, and I think we touched upon it briefly, you know, what are the avenues? Are there any avenues for the NIV applicant when the officer says no? So the answer really is that there are very limited avenues, and this is very important for us to understand because legal issues, meaning questions about the correct interpretation or application of law, can sometimes be escalated through the U.S. Department of State's legal advisory opinion section, sometimes referred to as LegalNet. But LegalNet is not a general appeal. It is not a way to relitigate factual findings or factual issues. It is purely for legal-related issues. So if the consular officer's decision rests on purely a factual determination, then that cannot be fixed through the Department of State Legal Advisory Opinion Section team or through LegalNet. There are also narrow situations where the NIV waiver request could be referred to the U.S. Department of State review even after a consular officer declines to recommend it, such as in cases involving diplomatic relations, national security, law enforcement related issues, significant public interest, or the catch-all urgent humanitarian or medical reasons. But that is not a routine second chance or opportunity. For most applicants, the factual records which is submitted at the beginning is the record that they are now committed to. And that is why accuracy and completeness in what you present and how you present it and how you, you know, submit it will make a world of difference between how a case is reviewed or potentially subject to getting approved or not. Okay, so what happens once? Let's say, yoo-hoo, the client gets the waiver. Maggie, Lori, you take care of it. Great news, right? How long is it valid for?
So that's the classic it depends answer. I mean, the statutory maximum for most multiple entry authorizations is 5 years. So that's the maximum. But in practice, first-time waivers are often granted for a shorter period. Those are frequently offered around a year. And though the period depends on the facts and the visa classifications, the purpose of the travel, and additionally the AR, you know, the ARO conditions, some later waiver approvals could be granted for a longer period. But again, they're only going to be granted up to that regulatory maximum, which is the 5 years. And additionally, you know, future waivers, if you apply for them, they're not automatic. Even if someone has been approved before, the next waiver could be denied. The consular officer and the ARO are going to look at the case again, and they're going to look at what happened since the last approval, whether or not the applicant has complied with their prior visa and the waiver terms, and additionally, whether the purpose of the travel remains appropriate. And when the waiver expires, you know, your original waiver expires, you know, if you want to travel again, you know, the applicant should expect to go through this process again. So there's no truly streamlined renewal track. It's just you kind of have to go through it all again.
Okay. So I know when both happens, you get the visa, the consular officer approves it, the ARO approves it, you get the visa waiver, you're like, is entry guaranteed in the U.S.? Lori?
Sure. So just one point that I wanted to kind of add to in terms of how long the waiver is valid, I wanted to, and this ties into whether the person's guaranteed entry, it's only valid for the type of visa that you applied for. So if it's issued in connection with an H-4 visa, then that waiver wouldn't be applicable if you wanted to enter the United States in another visa classification. So we like to point that out because it's not transferable, so to speak. So when the waiver is approved, the person is not necessarily guaranteed entry. The waiver allows the person to apply for admission despite, you know, their inadmissibility, but the visa allows the person to travel to a port of entry. So CBP still makes the kind of the final admission decision. The traveler also, you know, must follow any conditions attached to the waiver and visa, including the purpose of travel, the validity, number of entries, and authorized stay. So you want to make sure that all matches up.
Okay, great. So let's go back now that we have just a few minutes, and I know we try to wrap this up within a reasonable time, is what goes into a strong NIV waiver application and what kind of documentation could be helpful? The fundamental, foundational document is the personal statement. The applicant needs to explain in their own words exactly what happened, what caused the inadmissibility, why they're seeking temporary entry now. And besides the personal statement, which we just talked about how important that is, supporting documentation should be tailored to the ground of inadmissibility and the reason for the travel. The strongest applications identify the legal problem accurately, explain the facts honestly, and then connect the evidence to the discretionary factors. So what are the most common mistakes that we generally see that applicants make in these cases? Maggie?
Yeah, so the biggest one is incomplete disclosure. Applicants will sometimes omit prior arrests, and they'll omit things like visa refusals or immigration violations of any kind, or old incidents, just because they assume that the issue is too old or it won't be discovered. And that's really a serious mistake because these background checks are very thorough and an omission can be treated as a misrepresentation, which in turn may actually create a separate inadmissibility problem that can be really serious and damage credibility. So, and the other thing, it's not necessarily a mistake per se that will damage your application, but it's more of a mistake of expectations on the client's part. And that's underestimating the timeline or underestimating how long it takes for these waivers to come through. Because people often assume that, you know, you can get a waiver in a few months because the purpose of the travel feels urgent to them specifically, but the ARO processing can actually take around a year or longer. And expedite requests are, you know, as we talked about, very limited. So the real key here is to start early, get your records, be honest, and work with counsel to build a really, you know, the strongest case as possible before the case goes to the consulate and the ARO.
Great. Okay. Thank you, Maggie. Okay. So, Lori, I know we talked a little bit about the timelines, but I guess somewhat related issue is getting this 212D3 waiver, would it then help the person and clear up the inadmissibility for that person so that in the future, if the person wants to apply for a green card, the NIV waiver would cover that? I'm guessing the answer is no because it says NIV waiver, which is non-immigrant visa waiver, not the IV waiver, which is the immigrant visa waiver. But just put that out there because people sometimes do get confused.
Yeah, you're right about that, Sheila. It seems obvious, maybe at first look, but it's something that's missed and it can be confusing to a lot of people. So the INA, you know, 212D3 waiver is strictly a non-immigrant waiver, and it allows strictly for temporary entry into the United States for a specific purpose, which is what I was referring to earlier, for the specific visa that you've applied for a very specific period of time. And it does not waive inadmissibility for an immigrant visa or someone going through the green card process. If someone later applies for an immigrant visa at a consulate or seeks adjustment of status to permanent residence in the United States, the underlying inadmissibility is still in effect. So it does not, the inadmissibility itself is not, does not disappear, right? It remains on the person's record. And at that point, the person would need to determine whether or not a separate immigrant waiver is available. And that's really a whole nother field and discussion. Those waivers have different eligibility requirements and very different standards, so they really don't relate to one another. In many cases, they require a showing of extreme hardship to a qualifying U.S. citizen or a lawful permanent resident family member. And a prior 212D3 waiver approval does not carry over or grant any, you know, likelihood of success in the immigrant process. So they are very distinct from each other.
Okay. So as you can see, we have tried in the last, you know, almost 30 minutes, tried to cover in great detail how the process works for NIV waivers or 212D3 non-immigrant visa waivers. We have both Maggie and Lori sharing their wealth of wisdom and pearls of wisdom with you all to kind of give you some sense of how the process works. Clearly, as you can see, it's a complex, difficult, time-consuming process, but working with a experienced, knowledgeable team that has had success for years and years and decades with the law firm having worked on NIV waivers, I think will make a huge difference in trying to get these kinds of approvals. At the Murthy Law Firm, we clearly have the knowledge and a great team with the right experience and qualifications to help you, your family, your employees, or anyone else you may know to navigate this complex area. On behalf of myself, Sheila Murthy, on behalf of Maggie Wagner, Lori Haas, and our entire Murthy Law Firm team, thank you for joining us today and have a wonderful rest of your day. Bye-bye.
Unauthorized recording or dissemination of these materials without prior permission is prohibited by law. Learn about our firm, how to engage our services, and more at www.murthy.com.